The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
From MyDomain.com, this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today's guest, Tracy Sun, truly embodies the idea behind Second Life as she switched career paths in a shockingly big way. She moved from neuroscience to the fashion tech space as the co-founder and vice president of marketing for the fashion resale marketplace Poshmark. Yes. You heard that right. Tracy went from being pre-med in college and working with Alzheimer's and Parkinson's patients to pivoting into the fashion world and becoming an entrepreneur. Poshmark now has over 3 million sellers who upload over $4 million in inventory to the platform every single day, not to mention millions and millions of shoppers. Needless to say, it's quite the switch from neuroscience, which is why I'm so excited to have Tracy here today. This is Tracy Sun on Second Life. Okay, so Tracy, as always with this podcast, let's start at the beginning. What did you study in school and what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
So I studied biology and psychology in college. And backing up before that, I wanted to be a vet.
Oh.
I love animals, wanted to be a vet. And then my mom told me, Tracy, you're allergic to animals. I don't think you'll ever make it through veterinary school.
Were you really allergic? Are you?
I'm really allergic to animals. And I have a dog right now, so I just deal with it. But as a profession, I think it would not have worked. So that was my first calling, I think.
So you knew you wanted to do something, or you thought you wanted to do something in the medical world of some sort.
Yes. So okay. It was, isn't this great? I love animals. I want to help them. I want to be a vet. Wait, I'm allergic to animals. Okay, why don't I just be a doctor?
Pivot.
Pivot number one. So I studied biology and psychology in college, and I didn't just want to be a doctor. I was really interested in the brain and the mind and then the connection between the two. So I wanted to be a neurosurgeon.
Casual.
Mm-hmm. That's what I embarked on.
Okay, so then what happened next? Did you go to medical school?
I didn't. So what I did was during college, I spent every internship working at hospitals and research institutions.
All doing brain things?
Doing brain things, doing psychology things. And then my first job out of college, I spent 2 years in clinical neuroscience. So I was working with Alzheimer's and Parkinson's patients. We were trying to figure out what goes wrong, how we can help. And it was research, but working with patients. So it was the best, and I loved it so much.
Okay, so what was that like on a day-to-day basis? I mean, that also has to be really heavy. I mean, my paternal grandmother had Alzheimer's. It's debilitating. It's so frustrating. It's a really heart-wrenching disease. How was it working with Alzheimer's and Parkinson's patients on a daily basis?
So half of it was working with people, and that was the clinical side. And that was the part I loved because I love making connections with people. But to your, you know, with your experience, it was also the part that was really hard. It was the human part, but the part that was hard. The thing about neurodegenerative diseases is that by definition, those patients aren't going to get better. So that part is hard. So you do it with the hope and dream that you'll make it better for the next group of patients, and hopefully you can eradicate the kind of pain that you see people go through. The other part of my job was not working with people, and it was working with test tubes and numbers and statistical analyses and more research methodology, because at the end of the day, that's what I was doing. I was doing research.
Okay, so did you love it?
I loved it. It was so fun.
But then you left. So
I did. I left.
At what point did you start to think, maybe this isn't for me?
I would look at the people that I admired, the people who, if I could make it in life, this is what I would look like. And they were working alone. They're working in their office, albeit a very big office, and They're very important people in the academic world, so they had a lot of fame in that industry. But they're working alone, and they were looking at brain scans. And like I said, they're working with patients. They were helping them, but they would never see them again. And what I realized is that as much as I love studying it and I love the topic, the actual day-to-day work was not for me. There are people who can show up and be in a service role where just helping someone and touching someone for 30 minutes and then going away, that fulfills them. For me, touching someone for 30 minutes and not being able to follow up with them and hear what happened next, that actually left me a little bit empty.
Got it.
So subject matter I still love, and I still love reading all that stuff. And sometimes I get geeky and read like the science articles. But yes, I at some point pretty early in my career, I said, I don't think this is right for me.
So it's interesting that you say that, because I think you bring up a really good point and something that happened to me as well. When I worked at Elle Magazine, I looked at my bosses and my boss's bosses, and I realized that in print magazines at the time, the longer you were on staff, the higher up you got, the less writing you were doing, the less hands-on you were doing, and the more editing you were doing. And I liked the writing part of it. I wanted to be the one who was going on assignment somewhere. I didn't want to be the person who was in the office fixing other people's words. And that's in part what made me end up leaving that job to go freelance. And then I ended up editing anyway down the road. But it's an interesting thing when you have worked towards something for so long, and then you actually see the day-to-day and realize, oh, wait, this might not be the right fit for me.
Yes. And I
were you upset by that?
Oh, I was devastated. This was the only world I knew. Like many young people, you get, especially when you're really type A and ambitious, like, this is what I'm going to be. And it
fixated.
It gets wrapped up in your identity. Like, this is, like, I'm going to be a doctor. This is Tracy. And then when you realize, wait, I don't think that's it, there it leaves this hole. Like, well, what am I now? What all my friends are, they seem to know what they're doing. And the thing that I thought I was going to do just disappeared. So
what happened next?
What happened next was a year or two of just what is going on, quarter life crisis.
Ugh, and that is a real thing.
It is a real thing. And it's not the only crisis I've had. I've also had, a few crises between then and today. So you can, your listeners can look forward to that if they're younger than me.
I know. I feel like that's the thing. I'm like, guys, it just keeps happening.
It keeps coming. So just get used to it. Yep.
Okay. So you had some soul searching.
I had some soul searching.
What did you do during that time? And had you saved money? Were you worried about that part of it? Because that's one of the things I also try and talk about a fair amount with our guests on the podcast is like the realities of it. Like, had you saved money? Were you nervous? What was your whole lead up to that?
So I had no money during this time. Medical research is not a glamorous gig on the money front. I was living in New York City, where the only apartment I could afford had no bathroom. I was living with no bathroom. I was sharing it with people across the hall.
What?
That was the only way I could afford to live in New York on a researcher salary. So when I quit that, I was like, okay, I need some time. So let me get a job. And I ended up getting a businessy job at Canon USA, which is a technology company.
No way.
I had no idea what to do. I was like, but I'm generally smart. I can do these things. And so it was a little bit of a marketing role. And I realized, I was like, I don't even know anything aside from science. And the rest of the world seems to me like business. So I'm just going to go to business school and figure it out. So I ended up applying and going to business school.
Okay, so I have my master's in journalism from NYU, which is in part, I did that before I got my first job. And while I loved it and I needed that because I didn't figure out what I wanted to do until kind of later in college, and I feel like I needed that time so I could intern and actually get some like journalistic skills under my belt, I wouldn't necessarily recommend that path to everyone. Do you feel like people should have their MBA? Was it a good experience for you, and would you recommend it?
You know, that's such a good question. And I get asked that question so many times from a lot of young people who, because it's a big investment. It's 2 years
Huge.
Of your life. It's a lot of money. For me, it was the right decision. I think that every person should think about their own personal circumstances and evaluate and ask people who've went. So why did it make sense for me? It sounds like it's a lot of why it made sense for you. I didn't know the world outside of science. I really didn't know. I didn't know anything. And it made me feel like I wasn't prepared for the world. And so for me, getting my MBA was a crash course in the non-science world. And I did not know where I would end up, but at least I would learn something about how the world works, because so much of the world is business. Even if you're in a creative industry, it's still business of some sort. So what it gave me is the confidence, because while I went through those 2 years, the first 6 months, I was like, oh my God, all these bankers and consultants, they're so smart. They can crunch all these numbers, and I don't even know how to use Excel. And then I realized, you know what? You can learn all these things. It's not that hard. Oftentimes, it's just you don't understand the vocabulary. But once you get the vocabulary, it's not that hard. So what I got out of it, I still bring with me today, which is when I enter a new space, when I don't understand, I know that if I just spend a little bit of time and ask the right questions, I can figure it out.
It's just like learning a new language a little bit. But I think it's easier than learning a new language because I'm not great at languages. But it's that thing. You're totally right. It's about the language. It's about the words. It's about the way people talk about things. There's so many. Catherine, my business partner, and I always laugh because there's always jargon of the moment. And we'll be sitting in some sort of business meeting and then everyone will say this one thing. We just look at each other like, okay, like that's just like the cool way of saying, you know, change. It's like, oh, okay, no, I'm sorry. It's pivot now.
Right. Totally. No, I mean, I'm based in Silicon Valley, so we have our own jargon up there for sure.
100%. Okay, so you get your MBA, and then what happened next?
I get my MBA, and I, through networking and chance, I met up with these two entrepreneurs in Brooklyn, and I just loved what they were doing. They were two artists who were ripping down old billboard signs and taking that vinyl and making messenger bags out of them. And I just loved this idea that they were doing their art and then saying, okay, well, we'll just price it at whatever, and then all these people are buying, and that was allowing them to do more art. And they clearly needed a business person to help them. So I ended up joining forces with them. They're called Brooklyn Industries. They're still there in New York today. They're a much bigger company than just a husband and wife team today. But that was my first taste of retail, my first taste of fashion, and also, most importantly, what it's like to work at a startup.
So on that note, like, are you a fashion person? Would you have considered yourself a fashion person?
I would not have, and I still don't today.
So you work for this huge company. You've co-founded this huge company that works in the fashion and tech space, and yet you do not think of yourself as a fashion person.
That's right.
That's amazing.
That's right. I'm not the most fashionable. I love fashion, but I mostly love fashion because everybody wears it, and I'm so fascinated by what people wear and why they wear it and what it means, what it can tell the world about how they're feeling that day, or, you know, it's an expression of what, you know, creativity or mood they're in. And I love that, but I don't love necessarily keeping up on the trends and, you know, and I just right now I find all these excuses to wear sneakers all the time.
Well, you're very on trend with that, though. Sneakers are hugely having
the
moment.
That's right. And people think I'm so trendy, but the truth is I was wearing sneakers before the trend, and I will likely be wearing sneakers after. So just, you know.
Okay, so let's go back to Brooklyn Industries, right? Okay, so it's a startup, and that means that, at least for us, it was a lot of like doing everything. What kind of stuff were you learning? Were you able to work across lots of different aspects of the business? Were you making your own role? What was it like then?
So that's just the beauty of startups, is you really get your hands on everything. And my role there was started in business strategy, just informing from a financial perspective how to grow their business, but quickly turned into merchandising, planning, and then eventually I oversaw the fashion design department too. So from inspiration to sell through with a budget, I was making clothes.
That is, as a non-fashion person, that's really, really amazing.
It was so fun. And to the point we're talking about, it was just a new vocabulary. It was just, what does, you know, retail markup mean? What does inventory planning mean, and how do you account for all these various things? But once you have confidence in yourself and you just use your brain and you apply it, they're not hard principles, and they do apply from industry to industry. So while I was not doing planning in science, science did teach me numbers and how to logically put things together. And
accountability.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Which I think, too, is one of those things that it's always amazing to me how people feel like industries are so different, but yet there's this sort of through line of certain skills. It's like being resourceful and fact-checking and being thorough with your work and all of that stuff. It's like, no, that's just true across the board.
I agree with that so much. And because after fashion, after Brooklyn Industries, I eventually made my way to Silicon Valley.
Okay, so tell me that part of the story. What happened? How did you know it was time to leave? And what did you decide to leave for?
Okay, so after Brooklyn Industries, I started my own company in New York. It was a fashion company in New York. And it was a spectacular failure, right? We were so successful at launch that we took our entire site down and we ran out of money trying to get it back online.
So what was the company?
The company was it was called Established Today. And the idea was it was catered towards kids. And it was taking all of the principles I learned about designing fashion, deconstructing them down to algorithms or rules, and then empowering kids to make their own clothing and wear it to school.
That's amazing.
It was so fun, and it was so, and I remember we were smart enough to create an advisory board, but not smart enough to take their advice. So what happened was someone from Silicon
That's
Valley.
Very honest.
This was one of the most spectacular failures of my life, and I'm going to answer your question, why did I end up moving? Our advisor came and spent some time with us and said, you know, you guys are all very smart, but let me tell you your biggest weakness. You have a very big blind spot. Y'all are in New York, and you think you're a fashion company, and, you know, you act like a fashion company, and you're prioritizing based on brand and fashion. What you don't realize is you are a technology company. And you have no idea that you're a technology company, and so you're not prioritizing accordingly. And I was like, he doesn't know what he's talking about. We're building this cool brand, you know. And he was right. The reason why we launched and did so well is we prioritized all the business and marketing and fashion. We did not prioritize the technology, and the technology broke.
Whoa. Okay. That's actually crazy. What did you do in that moment?
We shut the company down.
How long had you been working on it?
We worked on it for about a year and a half. We raised about $1 million from friends and family to get us going. And it likely would have been enough to get us to that next round. What had happened is this was during the New York financial crisis. So,
no.
So that happened. And everyone who had believed in us and gave us that seed money, they were distracted by their own crisis and money really dried up.
I remember that so vividly because we launched our company in 2006.
Okay.
So it wasn't very long after that when the financial crisis hit. And at that point in time, we were solely supported by ad sales. And of course, the first budgets to get cut were digital budgets, even though now looking back, that was the worst thing to do because there could have been, you know, actual data on what was working and whatnot. But we had to circle the wagons. It was the scariest time. Did you feel prepared? You had left your first fashion job. You had started this new company. You'd taken money. You'd built this amazing thing. And then, you know, the world – the combination of like the world crisis, the financial crisis, and the tech crisis in your specific case all happened at the same time. How scared were you?
I was pretty scared. I was pretty scared. And I kept that to the inside because what was going on is that we were failing as a company, but it doesn't fail on a specific time and a specific day. It's like a slow fail. So we tried to get money, but and I tell you in hindsight, oh, we couldn't raise more money, but it took us 6 months of trying before we didn't raise any money and then we just called it. So it was kind of like a realization that this isn't going to work. And I think the hardest part were all the people who believed in us and believed in the vision. And they wanted to work for free. And they said, we'll keep it going. We'll get it back online. And when I had to turn to them and say, no, you know what? This is not fair to you. We're going to shut this down. And that was when I had closure on it. And
man.
So after that, I was less scared because now you know. Now you know what's going on. And quickly thereafter, I remembered what the advisor said. I remembered, You think you're a fashion company, but you're really a tech company. And that's when I realized I have learned so much about fashion, not necessarily what we consider fashion, but consumer fashion and how to sell to consumers. And what I didn't know was a technology. But I was so sure that some combination of the two was going to be the winning formula. And so I was not going to repeat that mistake. And I decided to pick up and leave and move to Silicon Valley because I truly believed at the time, and maybe that's changed a little bit, but not too much, that New York is a beautiful place to build a beautiful brand, not a great place to build a very strong technology company. And Silicon Valley is not a great place to build a brand. It's, you know, but I had that inside of me. So I picked up and I moved.
Okay. So what year is this?
This is 2009, 2010.
Okay. So you move to the West Coast. And then what did you decide to do?
I spent a year learning the vocabulary.
Okay.
Completely different vocabulary.
And what exactly does that mean? Were you just meeting with people? Were you freelancing? What were you doing?
I was meeting with people all the time. I was learning the industries. Silicon Valley has this funny way of referring to people by their first name. And I have no idea who Ben is. They'll say, Ben. I'm like, I don't know who that is. But people know because it's this slang about the hot startup. You know the founder's name and that's just what you do. And you know the VC's name by first name basis. So I spent a lot of time learning the people, the companies, the memes, the culture. They didn't care about brands at all. In fact, coming from New York and having built brands was actually not only was it not respected, but it was actually a mark against me.
Interesting.
In a way, because the culture is different. And so I had to learn that, and I had to learn how to position myself and learn this world so that I could then be part of it and build something out there.
Okay, so then how do you go from, you know, sort of like a reconnaissance year of fact-finding and getting the lay of the land to starting Poshmark?
Pretty simple. Part of that was looking
simple. Oh, no.
That one step was simple. Poshmark was not simple. Poshmark's anything but simple. Through networking, I met with lots of people, and what I was really looking for was one, inspiration, and two, a co-founder. And I quickly met both, and they came together. So I met Manish Chandra, who's the CEO, and quickly thereafter the other co-founders of Poshmark. And we just hit it off from a culture and values perspective. So I always tell people you spend more time with your co-founder often than you do with your family.
For sure.
So you would never get married without dating someone first, right? So it's the same thing with co-founders. So Manish and I dated. We like founder dated. We went to coffee shops. We discussed ideas. We learned how to brainstorm with one another. And we realized that it was going to work. That we respected each other enough and we had the same core values that wherever we ended up, we would make a good team. And so we partnered up and came up with the idea of Poshmark and recruited our two other co-founders who are our technical co-founders, and then the four of us moved forward.
So I love that idea. And it's true. It's like, you know, I feel like when you're interviewing for a job, it's this crazy thing because you can end up in a job for 3 or 4 or 5 years or however long you spend all this time there, and you're really meeting with someone a handful of times, if that,
right,
and trying to figure all of that out. So what are some of the things that – any tips that you have about whether it's networking or how do you recognize that someone is going to be a good culture fit for you?
I think you think about it like marriage.
Interesting.
Like you wouldn't – if you care about – like Manish and I share the value that we really care about people. And we really care about people. And that will always trump ego and money, right? So the company we've built is very much – you see it in the product. You see it in our community and you see it at our headquarters. It's all about people. We will take a hit to the top line if it means we're not treating our people well. And now if we didn't know that about each other, we'd constantly be fighting about it. You know, like one person would be like, well, that's not fair to our team. And the other person would be like, but that's not efficient with money. And we would have different values. So I think when you're looking for a co-founder or starting a project with someone, you really have to be like, would I marry them? You know, not for love, but it's a business marriage. And do I do I really believe in them? Do I think they're a good person? And I think it's much more that than do they have good ideas? Are they a good marketer? Like not their skills.
Because that's the sexy stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's like, oh, he's a good dresser.
Right.
Which, you know, doesn't really mean anything. Like, I'd rather someone who is like a good person but has terrible personal style, because you can easily change someone's personal style. Whereas, and I feel like that's kind of the same thing with when you're thinking about work, where you're like, okay, well, do I like their values? Because that's the sort of thing that's going to carry you through. I mean, Catherine and I laughed that we, before both of us got married, were married to each other first, because our finances and our career and like so many things were tied up together in the company. And it's really, I mean, it's like, it's a very emotionally intense thing too.
I totally agree. And when you do something like a startup, you know this, the highs are very high and they're fleeting, and the lows are very low and those are also fleeting. And if you don't have a really good partner in crime, it's devastating to go through that by yourself. And so, devastating, and I'm not sure it's advisable. I don't think it's best for the company to go through that by yourself. It's too much. And so having someone there who understands is really helpful.
So one of the things that we talk about on this podcast a lot is this idea that, as we've spoken about already, of taking skills that you hone in one part of your career and applying them to other things. So what are some of the things that you think about or do on a daily basis that are the same as when you worked in neuroscience?
Oh, that's such a good question. So I have this skill that I've picked up, and I'm still learning to apply. So it's still a work in progress, but it's this idea of not being attached to an outcome. So it could be something like, I thought I was going to be a neurosurgeon. And if I really got attached to that, I never would have discovered this whole other world that I'm in. My eyes would not have seen them. There would be doors opening for me, and I would be so laser focused on being a doctor, I wouldn't see the doors. Right. So I really say, like, trying not to get so attached to the outcome and really being present during the journey, because you never know where the journey is going to take you. And the journey is everything.
That's so true.
But it could be on a project level. Like, I could be doing something and I think that, oh, this is supposed to be my priority for the day. And then something else comes up. And if I get too attached to, no, this is what my schedule is going to be, and resist the change, I won't see the opportunity. So I'm constantly trying to work on that. And it's hard. But I think that with each day, with each job, I get better and better at it. And I think that's probably the number one thing I would advise to anyone who wants to do anything in life is, you know, like, really focus on the journey and don't get too attached on the outcome.
That's such a great thing, because it's true. You have this idea in your head of like how life is going to be. And it's in part why I actually resist having personal 5-year goals or 10-year goals, because to be perfectly frank, even though so many people recommend that and, you know, you have to have things to work for, and I agree with that idea in theory, but to be honest, my life has been so much more than I imagined for myself. Like, it, I mean, social didn't exist when we started
right.
our company. So I couldn't have imagined certain things because the technology wasn't there, or my brain just didn't know to even consider something. So I think there's something really important to, like, have a plan, have an idea, but you also have to remain open and not be so dogmatic and focused.
Sure. I love the idea of making decisions in life as if you only have, like, 5 years to live.
That's interesting,
right? So
too.
Let's say you only have 5 years to live. What would you do? And that's long enough where you have to pay attention to things like money, and you still need a house and
through.
Things like that. But it's not long enough for you to kind of mess around and waste the time. And so if you only have 5 years to live, what would you do? But then once you're on that path, continuously, like every 6 months to a year, being like, is this still right? And you might have to do that 5-year thought process like every 6 months.
Yeah.
Because we were talking about, you know, our careers early on. Once we got there, so for you at Elle and for me at Science, I didn't know that that's not what I wanted to do. It was so amazing. It's only when I got there and I started working at it did I see it. And so a lot of times you have to take a step to realize that step's actually not the right one for you.
100%. What advice would you give your younger self on that note?
I wish
besides listen to that advisor.
Do you know how much heartache I could save myself if I could actually talk to a 22-year-old Tracy? I would say, don't sweat it. Just don't sweat it. It's going to be fine. Like, I remember my quarter-life crisis, like, oh, no, I'm not going to be a doctor. What am I going to do? My whole life is ending. It's not true. That's just my career. But there's so much more to life than just your job and this job and this career. And when I calmed down and I let myself just live my life, and I'm still working on that, the more I do that, the more I just enjoy being here, talking to you and, you know, working at Poshmark with all the lovely people there. And it's what it is today, and it might change tomorrow, but it's so wonderful today. So why give yourself that anxiety of worrying about the future?
It's funny, though. As much as I worry about the future, I always have. I remember that right after I graduated from grad school, I had 2 weeks before going. It was, you know, the holidays in December before going back to New York to look for a job. And I ruined those 2 weeks because I was so concerned about never getting a job. And then I went back to New York and I got a job like 6 days later and then started working and have been working ever since. But I couldn't enjoy the moment at all because I was so concerned about what that next step was. And I see that anxiety in some of our younger staff where they want to know what the next step is and what the next step is after that. And they want the checklist and like, okay, well, then if I'm going to do this, then what's the next thing? What's the next thing? And they want to set themselves up for success. And I appreciate that tremendously. But I also think that there's something where it's like you also have to just like let go and be okay with not knowing.
Yeah. And I did the same thing.
Because your life can surprise you.
Absolutely. And I mentor a lot of the younger generation, and a lot of them, when they're super ambitious, are focused on like title and money. They want the promotion. They want to get paid more. And I think title and money are important, of course, but I know like in my bones that that's not what they want. They want acceptance. They want love. They want to make a difference in the world. They want to be challenged and stretch their brain. Those things are more important, but they don't know how to ask for those things, right? So, you know, what I would say to your listeners is like really think about what you want, because you can ask for those things. You can't – yes, you should ask for the raise and the promotion, but in my experience, most people want a really interesting project where they can learn, or they want to work with people where they feel respected, and that's what you remember. So again, if you're gonna only have 5 years left, does the promotion matter? Probably not. But working on a project,
does the work matter?
Yes. Does the work matter? It may not, depending mm-hmm. on who you are. But having fun with a team of five, trying to figure something out, staying up late and laughing about it, and then going out for a glass of wine after, that might be what it is.
Yeah. So a lot of our listeners are people who have had one, are in a certain career and they might have success and they might like it, or they might just be restless and they want to move to something else, whether it's their side hustle or another passion or just do something totally different. What advice would you give someone who is interested in making that leap but is scared?
So many things. The first one is, it's okay to be scared. If you weren't scared, you'd be a psychopath. Making a big change is scary. And that's part of the reason why it's so invigorating. Like, no one in their right mind wants to change everything in their life for fun, right? So changing a career, moving to a different location, taking a big project that you're not quite sure you can do, those are all scary. And so the first thing I would say is, you're totally normal. This is, and feeling scared is totally normal. So don't let that stop you. And then the second thing is you want to do it, just do it. And maybe you don't take the plunge, but you take a step. And then take another step, because each step you take, you will see things differently. And you might decide that's not the big plunge I want to take anymore. Or you might have more confidence and then you take 2 steps at a time, whatever it might be. But break it down into these little baby steps and just start moving forward. And if in your heart of hearts you know you want to do something, just move towards it. Because if you don't follow your heart, then what's the point of doing any of this?
I so appreciate that. And it's true that I also think that sometimes it can seem impossible to go from A to B. But if you really look at what that journey is and break it down into manageable chunks and specific tasks and specific steps, like you can start working. You don't have to take this huge leap. It could be something small and then something small and something small. And you build towards something. It doesn't have to be an all or nothing sort of moment.
Absolutely. And
other people things, forget that. They think like, I just have to abandon this and go to this other thing. It's like, no, like work towards it. Do it on the side. Get more familiar with it. Maybe it's not something that you love. Maybe it is something you love. But like take the time to actually figure that out.
Yes. And I think, take the time to talk about it. So, Poshmark, we have great PR about how amazing the company is and people are doing great. And my friends always say to me like, oh, life is so easy for you. I was like, don't believe the PR. It's never that simple. We hustled for 2 years to get that one tiny deal that, we announced in the press that made it look so shiny and neat. And it's the same thing with social media, right? Like everything looks so simple and fun and beautiful. And we don't share the vulnerability or the pain or the fear that we had to, embark on in order to get there. So that's why I'm so happy to be talking to you today and sharing stories about how, I'm not sure how I got here. I made mistakes along the way and I didn't. It's not like 10 years ago I said, I'm going to start a company that's going to do XYZ, right? But I got here. And so the more stories you hear where people are just making one decision at a time, one step at a time, and look where they are, if we share these stories, then I think we can really inspire each other to try these things.
I agree wholeheartedly. Tracy, this was so amazing.
It was fun. Thank you so much for having me.
That was so inspiring. You just made me get excited all over again. That was Poshmark co-founder and vice president of merchandising, Tracy Sun. Thank you guys for listening to this episode of Second Life. If you can't get enough interviews with inspiring women like Tracy, head on over to mydomain.com. As always, we're interested in who you'd like to hear from on the show, so send your request to secondlife@mydomain.com, or you can just DM me on Instagram @HillaryKerr. If you like today's show, please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to rate us and review us. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life by mydomain.com.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car right in your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.